Yes, good afternoon. Welcome yet again to the 2:30 session with Una Mannion, yet another Irish writer, and we can talk about that. So this is Una Mannion. I'll introduce in a moment. I'm Helen Elliott. I'm a journalist, and we're going to just talk for an hour about, not quite sure yet which direction it'll take. So perhaps if you have any questions, you could be thinking of them already. The acknowledgement of country, which is terribly important to all of us. We acknowledge this land that we meet on today is the traditional lands for the Kaurna people, and we respect their spiritual relationship to their country. We also acknowledge the Kaurna people as the custodians of the Adelaide regions, and that their cultural and heritage beliefs are still as important to the living Kaurna people today. I think that's it for housekeeping. Explain a bit about Una, who is actually an American, but to us she'll sound very Irish because she's lived in Ireland for 30 years, or almost 30 years, isn't it? Yes. She's born in Philadelphia and lives now in County Sligo, and she teaches literature and writing. And she also teaches something that's, I think, called on whatever, wherever it was I read, applied writing. So I think we need to talk about what applied writing is. You might know, but I'm not quite sure it is. Her first novel was published 3 years ago. It's called The Crooked Tree. And her second novel, which is what we should talk more about today, is called Tell Me What I Am. And both, I think both have been described as pacey psychological thrillers. That's another thing we really need to talk about. I wouldn't have imagined that they would have been fitted into any category, but I'm not sure that categories of any kind are relevant now. But Una, you originally had a tension for being a poet. And can you tell me how that translates? How does poetry become prose?
I have written poetry, but I always feel like an imposter when people ask me about being a poet, because I think most of the times that I've written poetry, it started as prose, and then the register changed, and maybe because of the subject matter, that the register changed, and it became, I started to compress and do line breaks, and I guess begin to think about it structurally as a poem. But I probably am reticent to call myself a poet. That being said, I love words, and even some mornings when I sit down to write, I'll read poetry first, just to kind of sit in words for a little bit before I go to the laptop. I like
it's clarifying to,
and it's just, I think it it just remind me a little bit to think, maybe to slow down and think about the words rather than just the meat and potato sentences, you know, to try to remember how beautiful language is. But I love poetry, and I think it has impacted what I've written, but I'm not, I feel like afraid to say I'm a poet. So.
But you won a very important prize that brought you to the attention of very important people.
Yeah, so in Ireland, I won the Emerging Poetry Award. It's called the Hennessy Award, I think in 2017. And it did, I mean, one of the things about Ireland was I entered that poem. I sent it to the Irish Times, who at the time were running the Hennessy. I didn't know anyone. I'd never published anything. And I was writing, and I was writing with the writing group. But I think I had maybe turned 50 already. So, you know, I was coming to writing late. But because it first got shortlisted and got published and then it won the overall award, it gave me confidence that this is open to people, and it's not about who you know, and it's not a closed shop writing in Ireland. And I did get opportunities because of it, yeah.
I hope you heard that. It's not a closed shop in Ireland, and it's not who you know. It's quite different, I think. I don't know. What's the population of Ireland? About 7 million? It's smaller.
No, it's probably about 4 million, just over 4 million.
Oh, well, it's so small. And yes, because New Zealand also has this extraordinary, intense literary culture. But, I mean, you have... doing research, thinking about you today, I'm looking at all this, you know, I was thinking, oh, that's a lovely thing. This person said, and it was Iris Murdoch, Irish, and I was talking to you before about Molly Keane. I don't know whether anyone remembers Molly Keane, and all these just brilliant writers, just about every second writer in the English language. Actually, and I was thinking, does it come from, people keep saying, this is going to be a question 10, but here I am talking, so we can do it now, but is it to do with being silent? Silence is good behaviour. That's why I was looking at Molly Keane. Silence is good behaviour, or good behaviour is silence. You don't say anything. Molly Keane's husband died, so she went off lamp shopping. She loved him. She loved him. She would have thrown herself into the grave. She went off. She was so distressed, but she went off shopping for lamps in London in 1946, and she didn't even have a didn't go to the funeral. And nothing was said, and that was the way people dealt with grief. And I'm thinking in Ireland there's been such a history, such a past, that this silence puts everything... So what happens to the emotions and the language and the distilling of the language?
Yeah, I think, I mean, Ireland, first of all, because the Irish language was banned and suppressed, and so a lot of... the ways in which language and culture was retained was like through an oral tradition, and that's quite powerful in Ireland. You know, the storytelling tradition and the Shanachie, the storyteller, but also through music, and also people working between two languages. You know, the working through Irish or Gaelic. And then English, that maybe there was a particular awareness of language, but I think like so much of cultural memory and who people were was there in the stories that were being told. And so, I mean, and there's a great respect in Ireland for music and writing that goes very deep.
Yes, and Una would know, you probably, unlike me, would have, her partner of, 35 years, you said, belongs to a very, very famous Irish folk band called Dervish, is that right? And go to the world. So yes, so she knows about the culture from music and as well. But I think it is. It's interesting. We could talk endlessly about Ireland, but your books are set in America because you grew up in America. You were one of 1,000 children.
I was number six, six of eight children, which meant, like, you know, I'd lost, you know, I didn't matter, I guess, just chased. You must be one of, you're obviously from a big family as well, you have your pack, you know, you're part of a pack and you have your place in the pack. Mm. I grew up in Philadelphia. My father's from Sligo, and I grew up, I'm one of eight children, and there was eight of us within 10 years, so we were very close in age. And when I was four, my mother and father divorced, which was really unheard of in an Irish Catholic family in 1970. And my father went home to Ireland, but never told his family. And we were never allowed to tell our family in Ireland that my parents were divorced. So we did this kind of pretend, you know, that we all still lived together and that Papa was in our house. And when he was in America and he wasn't, he came back to America. But for me, I think, you know, maybe that idea of you write from your first place often, you know, so the first book was probably had a lot of autobiographical elements. I wrote it about the place where I grew up. I drew a little bit on family, and the second book ended up also being in America. And maybe it's because I'm away from America and that sense of, you know, exile or loss, you know, that you're writing your way home a little bit or writing your way back to childhood, and the things that I miss. And the A Crooked Tree, which is my first novel, the very opening scene, the book opens with a mother driving five kids in a car who are all fighting, which is like very familiar to me, and pulls in at dusk at the side of the road and throws out a 12-year-old child and tells her to walk the rest of the way home. And the book is narrated by the 15-year-old sister, you know, who's looking back as they drive away. And the 12-year-old, you know, decides to hitch and gets into the wrong car. And that sort of sets off the cycle of events. But that actually happened in my family. So I was sort of, I drew on that initial experience. My sister, my mom, I was actually younger rather than older in terms of narration, but I was 10, and my older sister got, you know, she hitched and did get into the wrong car. And so I think that first book, there's elements of my own life in it, but it's also a fictionalized version. And I was talking earlier in the week about this on a different panel. When I wrote the second book, which begins with a woman, a sister, going to work in the morning and not arriving, it never occurred to me that both books actually begin with sisters disappearing. I hadn't consciously done that, and I wasn't aware of it until last summer. I was at a library event in Ireland, and a young woman in the audience asked the question, and I still, my mind goes, whoa, that I didn't see that both books begin with like a sister, a loss, the anxiety around a sister disappearing.
Well, we can actually have a mass therapy session, if you like, about mothers who let their children out of the car. It makes me feel very judgmental and puritanical. So what's it done to you? I understand the book changed my year.
Yeah. But it's funny because I read the Goodreads thread and people were like, I cannot read this book. This mother is horrible. And I was thinking, well, it was 1970. Like, she didn't expect that would happen. And I think it was a different time, you know. And so there's that payoff of, like, I'm not saying it was responsible or, I mean, it was obviously, I would never do that. But she also had 8 children and we were pretty feral, to be honest. You know, we were...
The children are feral in the book.
Yeah, we are.
They look after themselves, really.
Yeah. And I think maybe in the 1970s, a lot of children did.
Oh, those damned hippies.
Yeah. Parents might be working. Yeah. There was, you know, you're just... children reared each other.
Yes. And that sisterly thing, it's so... compressed in the second book, which is also about, as one of the sisters says to, when she's trying to explain why she's with this totally dreadful man, why she loves what she shouldn't love and why she was so attracted in the first place. She met him when she was at her most powerful. And isn't that true? It's a very in-depth study of why we are attracted to people who are cruel and will...
Yeah, so in this book, the book opens with the disappearance of a woman. And she leaves behind her sister and her 4-year-old daughter, who they're all living together. She's estranged from her ex-partner. And from the very beginning of her disappearance... The sister believes that he has something to do with it. And the novel is told from both the perspective of the young child and the aunt, who has been denied third-party visitation. She can't even see this child that has grown up in her house because he has full custody and he can say it's traumatic for her you know, her mother abandoned her because the mother is a Missim. But what we learn over the course of the novel is more about him. And I think when I was trying to write that character and why Dina would have been drawn to him in the first place is that I think men like that can be incredibly charismatic and very compelling. And he's a kind of alpha male, you know, he hunts and he's from Vermont and they're from Philadelphia, and you know, he doesn't give, you know, opinions, he gives the answers. And she's had a little bit of instability in her life, so there's suddenly this person who's like really quite stable, she thinks, and older than her, and you know, very quickly it turns into a controlling situation.
Yes, I don't think I've ever read any novel where a controlling man, like the seductive, it's about the seduction of the control and also the submissiveness of the woman. And look, there's I've got lots of notes, but there's one particular, there are lots of places, but you do things by image, metaphor, being a poet. You know, this book is so layered and so textured and really quite complex, and you do have to read it carefully and slowly. My partner read it, and he's not a reader, and he couldn't stop. He said, "I'm just completely mind blown by what she's done here," described these people that I had no understanding of. I mean, it's another level of psychological understanding in words, in language, on a physical paper. And one of the ways you've done it is, I know, that where they're talking about dogs.
Oh, yeah. So I think it's a bit dark, but I did a lot of research for the book. I mean, including, I spent three days with the homicide unit in Philadelphia. And I was actually just looking, because I was trying to think about, in Australia, there's like 26 million people, I think.
Yep.
And Philadelphia has just 1.5 million, which maybe isn't that much bigger than Adelaide. And per annum, like in 2021, 572 people were murdered in Philadelphia. And in Australia, I think it was 278. Like, so you can imagine the homicide unit in Philadelphia, the kind of...
Guns. We don't have guns.
Exactly, yeah. And but also, I was doing a lot of research around, domestic violence and control. And one of the things that was talked about is this idea of learned helplessness. And in some of the literature, they compare it to this... these experiments that they've done with dogs, where the dogs are put on an electrified grid, and they shock the dogs. And the dogs who receive random, unprovoked shocks that they can't control begin to just lie down and take it. So even when the door is open, they don't go out the door. They've just learned that this is... you know, that they have lost all their agency or sense of self. And there's a scene where they're watching science program on a science cable television, and they're looking, you know, the two sisters, and they get it. You know, they realize that happened to her. And some of the other that aren't in the book, but I was, you know, they've done experiments where mice are abused in the nest. And the mice will always find their way back to the nest, even though it's the place that they've been hurt. And they've been shown other possibilities, but their home, they go, you know, they keep returning home. So I think some of those pieces find their way into the book. But she also did find her way out of that relationship. Yes. And I think things like... you know, I think a lot of people internalize shame. If you live in a family where there's domestic violence or you've experienced domestic violence, because people traditionally didn't talk, you know, that's their business kind of thing. And so for, there's that element of internalizing the shame, but also the safety and trying to get away. You know, that I think women have had to be cautious.
Yes, yes. So the book is also, if you probably haven't read it, so I don't want to be boring and it's complex too, because it's about the Ruby, the four-year-old, as she's growing up. It's about the aunt who desperately wants to be in touch with her and who manages, despite this man's controlling life, in a most beautiful physical landscape. That's the other thing. And she has this little girl. He brings her up, but he's very controlling. But it's a beautiful place. And you find yourself reading and thinking, well, this is what a lovely life this girl's having. And the grandmother, called Clover, is there too. So, I mean, that's all important, isn't it? Constructing a life, external.
Yeah, so when the father takes her, after the mother disappears, he takes her to rural Vermont. And she, so she grows up in this really beautiful, idyllic place where she can fish and hunt, and she's exposed to nature. Initially, he's homeschooling her, so she's very little kind of contact with the external world. But it was, I've actually spent some time on that Lake Champlain in Vermont. It's a stunning environment. I also wanted to create, I was looking for like an internal island space. I wanted him to take her to an island. And the title, Tell Me What I Am, is taken from The Tempest, William Shakespeare's Tempest. Yeah. And in that story, many of you will know, this father, Prospero, lands on an island with his three-year-old daughter, and encounters the inhabitants of the island, whom he quickly enslaves. And so not only is he controlling in terms of the history and the historical memory and cultural memory of the island, he controls her narrative and her understanding of who she is. So she doesn't know her story. I really wanted that idea that there's some kind of recovery that can happen, you know, that we can remember even when we can't cognitively remember, that we remember in other ways because other people remember, because our body remembers, because we remember feelings. And Milan Kundera has this beautiful line about, you know, the struggle against power is always the struggle of memory against forgetting.
Yes.
And that there's a kind of violence that happens in forgetting. And so for me, the idea of this father not just hurting the mother, but erasing the memory of her, like who will tell her about her mother? Like who will tell her? And so for me, maybe the book itself is hopefully an act of recovery. Before I wrote this book, Anne Carson has, the poet, the Canadian poet, has this really, really beautiful poem called Knox about her brother who disappeared. And eventually, about 20-some years after he disappeared, they discovered that he's died. And there's this line in the book, a brother never ends. And it just was like, phew, you know, that blow to the chest when you read something. And I just was thinking, all these people who keep vigil for other people, and try to keep them in the public consciousness, or, you know, want them to be remembered.
Yes, it's ending in South America. They disappeared. A movement of memory is just political as well as internal.
I think that, like, when you think about the disappeared, like in a place like Argentina, you know, like 30,000 young people who are protesting the regime, who are disappeared, and the cultural anxiety it creates, because when someone disappears, they're not gone, but they're not here, and they're in this purgatory, this limbo where we can't reach them and we can't know. And I think it creates a deep cultural anxiety, that idea of someone caught somewhere. And so I think when people talk about the importance, like we in Ireland, there's so much debate at the moment about babies who died in the mother and baby homes, and who were, you know, like there's debates at the moment, like some families were like, we want them back. You know, we want the DNA testing, and other people are like, you know, let the dead rest. And it's hard to know.
Yes, what Jung would call it a psychic. These are psychic wounds, and psychic wounds are things we don't know about. And this is what art is for, to tell us what we don't know about that we actually know about, and we carry it in our bodies. But then people like you come along and give us words, and you recognize them when you read them, and you think, oh, yes, that's it. That's how I felt. And I think it's just the wonder. Actually, I was going at the... Your epigram is De Quincey, Thomas De Quincey, who was, I think, famous for smoking opium, but he said a lot of other... said lovely things. Just a small... it's not a poem, is it? It's just a couple of...
It's an excerpt from...
Yes, it's... it's about how... Actually, it applies to books, but also to life. This is life. Everlasting layers of ideas, images, feelings have fallen upon your brain... softly as light. Each succession has seemed to bury all that went before, and yet, in reality, not one has been extinguished. And I think that's immaculate, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I really, it wasn't a word I knew before, palimpsest, and I may be destroying the pronunciation, so if there's any... academics in the audience, forgive me, but a palimpsest, I first heard it in terms of art, where there's a canvas, and there's a sketch or something, and then someone might draw over it or paint over it, and that idea of the trace of the thing that's underneath still is there, and I really loved that, and we see it all the time, like in built environments where we see ruins, and we see the trace of something that was there before, but I loved that idea of, again, maybe in terms of recovery, and that something is always there. The past is always just beneath us, informing us. You know, we're still living with the traces of it. And I suppose for Ruby, the child kind of trying to figure out who she is, and hopefully ultimately thinking, remembering her mother in a kind of recovering way of, you know, putting her back together and some way holding her is... I hope
book
does.
And she also has a grandmother called Clover that she lives with, and Clover is very withdrawn, and something traumatic has just blown her up, obviously, in her past. She was obviously, whatever. And at the mercy of men, I think, or male behaviour. But Clover, then, they live in this house, and Ruby's shocked. At one stage, when Clover tells her that her bedroom belonged to Clover's mother, and you know, and she had no idea, and Clover is really rattled by this. She's about 12 at that stage.
She knows so little. She's living. She's come from this incredibly gregarious Italian Irish family. Her grandfather's Irish. And the grandmother on the mother's side is Italian. So, and she was surrounded by these people. And then she goes up to rural Vermont, and she's living with her father and his mother, Clover. And they're completely austere, staunch New Englanders, kind of, you know, live in a harsh landscape. And Clover, she's always been around difficult men. She says that, I've always been around difficult men. But what happens to Clover in the course of the novel, and I think this, she gets a friend. So she's Ruby in her life now, and she makes a friend with the neighbor that she's lived with, who's been down the road from her for 50 years. And I think part of what happens in the novel and is her that friendship bolsters her in a way. Having a female friend transforms her. And I was also reading... there's a woman in America who keeps this database, and it's going to sound really gruesome, but it's a database of missing people. She's neurodivergent, and she's spent the last a decade. She just compiles articles and keeps a file on every missing person, and it's not she's not writing about them. She's just keeping them in the public consciousness. But I was reading a lot of those stories as I was working on the book, and one of them. twice I came across mothers who gave deathbed testimonies that where they had been the alibis for their sons, where they gave deathbed testimonies that caused their sons to be arrested. And I found that fascinating, like that, because the difficulty of a mother who might know something or knows and holds that secret and bears that burden, and then, you know, doesn't want to carry that to the next place. And yeah, that sounds like a spoiler, but it's not quite.
No, we can't talk about that any. Perhaps I was thinking, because we're talking about this writing, this applied writing, and there'll be probably a lot of people here who want to write and want to know about your process, because you teach it at a really remarkable group. Can you tell us about this writing group you belong? You don't. It's abandoned now, but who they've all, you know, so, famous people come, who came.
So yeah, I think I mentioned earlier that I came to writing late, obviously, and so in 2014, I don't know if any of you have ever done The Artist's Way. And it's this book where you do the morning pages. And in 2014, on New Year's Day, I found my morning pages from 2003. And they were like, I wish I would write. I really want to be a writer. And I'd done nothing about it. And I had that kind of moment of like, I'm either never going to do it, and I'm going to live my life with a feeling of real defeat and disappointment in myself, or I'm gonna try. And I started a writing group, and it just became this like incredibly dynamic group. So we gathered. Only one woman, an older woman who's a poet, had ever published before. All of us wrote our first stories in the group. It includes Louise Kennedy, and I don't know, she was here last year, but Louise Kennedy has won, like, she was shortlisted for the Women's Prize last year. She won the British Novel of the Year and the Irish Novel of the Year.
Trespasses.
Trespasses is her novel, but she'd never written a story until the spring of 2014. And the writing group, what we decided from the very beginning was that one of us would submit each week. We wanted robust feedback. So if you're going to be in the group and didn't want robust feedback, it probably wasn't the group for you. But this was the collectively we decided it. And because you're in a group and everyone is submitting each week, I work full time. I had three kids. My husband was like on tour all the time, you know, so I was on my own. But if it was my turn and no one else had dropped the ball yet, it wasn't going to be me. like 4 or 5 in the morning, I would get the submission in. But it was just because it was so disciplined, it worked. And we were all writing, and none of us were like really thinking about publishing or even knew anything about it.
That's interesting. So you were writing, you said you just wanted to be a writer. I mean,
at some level, I thought I'd love to be published. But when we first started writing, I wouldn't even have known what that looked like. You know, how does one go about getting published? But there was a woman in our group, and she found different competitions in Ireland, and she said, we're all sending to this. So we all sent to the Fish West Cork Writing Festival. And I was at the bank, the swim bank. I don't know if you all know what that hell is, where your children swim and you suffocate on the bleachers sometimes at 5 in the morning. I was in the bank at the pool, and I opened my email, and they had the festival long list and short list. We'd all made the short list, and about 4 of us had made the elation still is. Like, so those little things, like, I think a long list or a short list might seem like nothing, but for someone starting out, that affirmation of the thing that you're doing in the lonely time at all hours. And I used to drive my kids to discos and do the lock-in in the car, you know, so like write in the car until the disco was over, you know, because I lived in the middle of nowhere. So they couldn't, you know, I had to go in. And, you know, I was writing whenever I could find time. And I still do. I mean, I tell my students, like, write every day, have a practice, you know, but I can't do that because I don't have that time. So I tend to write in really, really disciplined spurts. So I might take 2 weeks and I'd write 15 hours a day. Like I would leave with at least, and it would be a really, really shitty draft. It would be dreadful, but I would have a draft, not a full, like maybe a story draft or whatever. And then I think the real crafting happens.
Yes.
You know, I always say to my students, and I don't know, that they always look at me like, well, I'm like, give me your ugly writing, you know, like, because you can be perfect and late and, you know, just trying to write initially, I think, is the hardest part.
And what about that's what everybody, I think, balks at, the gate of craft. You know, because the better the writing is, the more effortless it'll appear, you know, it'll be transparent, the effortless, and it'll appear to be so easy, but it's the craft in it, and that's the thing. Actually, Michael Houellebecq said he talks about writer's block and about craft, and it's very useful, I think, if you're a writer. I don't know whether you do this. He said you sit there and you don't know what, but you start at what you start at the beginning every time and go through. And it gets better and better and better. And is this what you find, that you...
Definitely. I think, so it's interesting, I did, Kevin Barry, who's an Irish writer, was, I interviewed him recently in Sligo, and he was saying that a lot of his stories might be 400, his books might be 400,000 words, and he'll parse that down to about 90,000.
Yeah.
But I did an event last Friday night with a Galway-based writer, Mike McCormick, and he was saying he starts off with a very thin story, and through each iteration, he keeps adding, biggering it up. I think I overwrite and then cut, but I think it's like an accordion or a concertina that you're contracting and expanding all the time, and cutting is so satisfying. Going through a document and cutting out the excess and finding that those moments that just aren't necessary is so joyful. But there are also times, like, when I read this book after the first draft, I knew, like, in a really uncomfortable way, I had made the father, Lucas is his name, I felt like he was a caricature of a controlling man. And it wasn't authentic, it didn't feel nuanced. And I found it hard, but I had to go back in and write scenes for him to give him more humanity, to make us understand how Ruby is so completely under his grip. So I wrote a scene where, this actually happened when I was in Vermont, because my brother was caretaking on this island in the middle of the lake called Savage Island, and he was there through the winter, where, like, the lake freezes over and big trucks can drive across the lake. But I went to visit him in the summer, and his daughter came with me. She lives in Georgia, and he mail ordered chicks in the post. You know, they came to the local post office, and we went and collected a box of little chicks, because they can live off the yolk for 72 hours, and so I wrote a scene where he orders chicks and one dies and he scoops it away, and, you know, we get the sense of him being tender and trying to protect her from death, and those types of scenes I had to add in. So I was expanding, but mostly first draft, 120,000 words that I sent to my agent. I cut 60,000 and added 30. To give you an idea, so the book is about 90,000 words, and that was the process.
So you couldn't. A big prize here is called. It's by Jessica Arles' book. It won the Prime Minister's Fiction Award, and it's a lot of money. It's the biggest, one of the biggest prizes. It's 100 pages. How would you go with 100 pages? A novel of 100 pages? Could you? You're not. Are you a dandy with words enough to?
So you mean
compressed?
How compressed that must
yes,
be?
Yes. Could you? Is this? It wouldn't be natural for you to do that. You would.
I don't know, but I found that there's definitely a trend for the shorter novel at the moment. And I like Claire Keegan, an Irish writer. Mm. Her books, you know, there's a lot of debate. Like, are they short stories or novellas, or they're being called novels? Like, what exactly are they? And I'm not sure that it matters so much. Like, you know, what call it. Yeah. You know, it's. I'm not going to be like, I'm not going to read that because it's a short story, you know, as opposed to a novel. But there seems to definitely, in Irish publishing and in the UK, there's a trend at the moment for very short.
Yes, yeah. Here too, yes. Yeah. And why, I wonder if it's to do with we don't have the, well, we certainly don't have the concentration. Your books demand concentration. And I mean, it's quite a risk in a way to, for readers of novels these days to keep all of this in their head, I think. Is that so, or is that just me being old?
Because movies are getting longer. Like, movies, you know, have to be like 3 hours now, and we'd be like...
Oh, yeah, but series. Everyone wants a series. Actually, that's interesting, because we watch series, and it's very detailed and psychological. And, in fact, I don't like watching films anymore because I want a series. So why do we want short novels?
Yeah, I'm not sure, because I think that there's something quite beautiful in that, but those books that, like... That sits somewhere between the lyric and prose, like, and I think some of those more compressed books can do that. Where it might be harder to do that in a much longer work, to be experimenting with language, you know. I think. So I mean, I love Claire Keegan's work, so you know, and would read.
You're experimenting here with psychology, with. The soul, the spirit, everything, you know, which as well. So,
I don't think of myself as an experimental writer, but certainly, and I'm also not a writer who plots in advance. So for me, like I had an idea or an image that I began with, but I didn't know quite where it would go.
And what was that? Can you?
For this particular book, I knew someone who disappeared and who's never been found, and I knew that she had a child, and this is a very, very long time ago, but it was that kind of thing that just, you know, it was always there on the periphery of my conscious, like I thought about it often, you know, maybe 5 years would pass and I wouldn't have thought about it, and then I would think about it again, and I think that those questions around the child is, I think, and so I began with the character Ruby. I just read Anna Burns's Milkman. I don't know if any of you have read that novel, but it's really, really frenetically intense. And when I started Ruby's chapters, because I wrote her first, and then I wrote her aunt, and then I staggered, I began to think about how they might sit together. Ruby's initial chapters came out like Anna Burns, like very, very intense stream of consciousness almost. And then I kind of tidied that up more. But
that's interesting, because a lot of writers say they won't read anything when they're writing, because writing, you start writing by being an imitator. You start any art, don't you, by imitating. And then you tap into your own thing. So do you read while you're...
Definitely, all the time. I was reading, when I was writing this book, I was reading this book by The Mars Room by Rachel Kushner, an American writer about female incarceration in America. And I was interested, it was helping me to think about how different voices, like that you could have a book, you know, have multiple voices, and she has many voices, but she also did this really interesting thing where she would have a page that was just like the rules for what you can wear when you visit someone in the prison. And it's actually mind-blowing. It did so much work in that novel. Those just forms that you have to fill out, and they're devastating. That they contradict, you know, you can't show, like it was about how much flesh you could show, you know, in going to visit someone in a prison. And initially I had tried to do something like that with the things like Inescapable Shock, and I was trying to, like, I ended up getting rid of them, and some of them got integrated, but it really helped me to kind of move the novel or to think about what am I trying to write. So sometimes just reading somebody else can be really useful in thinking about structure, keeping you motivated. I don't go into a silo at all. I think I'm always trying to learn from other writers.
And you do. I think one big stumbling block with people trying to write, they think they'll have nothing original to say. But who's the poet, Marianne Moore, said, originality is a byproduct of sincerity. So if you can tap into that sincerity of your own, it doesn't matter what you read. The more you know, the better, because the wider you're reading, the better understanding, the better grip you've got on form. And it's really about form, isn't it? But it is to do with your own sincerity, if you can be sincere.
I think vantage point, ultimately, I think we're all kind of writing about similar things to a certain extent, like loss, you know, pain, hope, like these abstractions, but only we can know it from a particular vantage point or try to, with empathy, inhabit a certain vantage point. And I think that's reassuring. I don't think I'm going to, you know, write the great American or the great Irish novel, but from my little corner, I can write with the details that are available to me, and the experiences maybe that I've distilled.
Well, you've done exactly. Nabokov said, if you're a writer, you have to fondle the detail.
Yes.
And I think that's just
an unfortunate word, but yeah.
I know. Well, typically Nabokov.
Lolita, but yeah.
But you fondled the detail with great individuality. I think it's time for, if anybody in the audience would like to ask some questions. Somebody's coming up. No, I can't see. Nobody. Somebody. Sorry, you're behind the lamppost.
I know that you're busy with like family and your husband was away. So what motivated you to, I know there was like the time limit that motivated you, but what sort of, if you can describe the feeling inside of you that motivated you to finish that work even when there wasn't a deadline?
Yeah, I think that anyone who, so initially when we were writing short stories and that feeling of finishing something is quite, it doesn't matter if it got shortlisted, longlisted. I think when you put something in the world that wasn't there before, that you created something, is kind of a feeling that I don't know how to match that. And I don't like love writing, to be honest. I tear my hair out, I force myself, but I really, really don't like myself when I'm not writing. And so then I've put myself into this thing. And so, like, obviously getting published has been hugely important in my life and a validation, you know, for someone I've not ever had a lot of confidence. It was a validation that was so important to me. But
can you explain about that, about your publisher? Because that's very interesting to us.
How I got published.
Yeah, the great, well, Peter.
I always tell my students as well, we were doing that thing of like entering story competitions, and there was she's a books journalist, and she did the book show on RTE, which is like our main radio television. Erin is the, you know, so she was like a presenter, and she judged several competitions that I won, and without telling me, she sent all the work that I had published online to her agent, who's Peter Strauss. And Peter Strauss like represents Ishiguro and Enright and Colm Tobin, and he's kind of like, he's pretty amazing. And I was in my Shakespeare class, and I got a message, an email to say, from this woman, Sinead Gleason, to say, Peter Strauss is going to ring you. If you see a UK number, answer the phone. So the UK number came up, and I was like, students, like, I have to just go outside, you know. So he just said, I've read your stories, and I really like the voice, and I'm interested in to know if you have a novel. I heard you might have a novel. And I had literally just finished a first draft of a novel, and this was October. And he said, when can I see it? And I said, the end of January. So, like, that motivated me beyond, like, there was no Christmas. I was like, get your own gifts. Like, somebody, you know, just tell everyone there's no Santa. Like, you know, just like, I literally, you know, I really, really did kind of phenomenal hours, but I was beside myself. And then when he said he'd like to sign me, I was, you know, it was amazing. Thank you for your questions.
Yes, you're on.
Oh, I was just wondering if there's time, if you could read us a short extract from your book.
Sure, sure, yeah. I wouldn't typically read this, but I was thinking about it a lot since I've been here and listening to a lot of, I've been thinking about Frederick Douglass. Since I've been in Australia, I find it really moving, like the recognition of the land that we're on at the start of every event, a consciousness that, like, in America just isn't there at all. I grew up on Lenape land. I only found that out when I was writing my last book, you know, and realized that all the trails I'd run around on in my childhood were Lenape trails, and there's zero acknowledgement of it. So I'm just going to read, when Ruby's seventh grade class are reading Frederick Douglass' the narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass, an American slave. Miss Tierney put Christmas lights up in the English language and arts room. She said it helped have extra light coming into the darkest days. The whole seventh grade had been assigned narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass, an American slave, and they discussed it while the lights twinkled along the walls. Ruby had never read someone's real account of their own life and experiences. She hadn't been able to put it down and read all 11 chapters in one go. Frederick Douglass didn't know when he was born. Slave owners never told their slaves their birthdays. He didn't know any slaves who knew the date of their birth. Most didn't even know their mothers. He described how his had been taken away from him when he was an infant, a thing that was common practice in that part of Maryland, usually before the child was a year old. Douglass wrote that he did not know why they did this except to blunt and destroy the relationship. Douglass's mother was sent to work as a field hand 12 miles away. She used to walk back at night to the farm where he was and hold him in the dark. Then she would get up and walk back the 12 miles to be working in the field on the other farm by sunrise. Ruby thought of the young Frederick Douglass, what that must have been like for him as a child, to have this person come and hold you at night, a body safe and familiar and so full of love for you that they would come all that distance just to have the opportunity to hold you while you drifted off to sleep. Douglass's mother died when he was maybe 7. Ruby's lungs ached when she read that, as if she had run a fast race in freezing air temperatures.
Thank you.
Frederick Douglass came to Ireland and was appalled by British imperialism in Ireland, and wrote and talked about it quite extensively. And so, like, the Irish have a particular love for him.
Now you have one more question, I think.
I think you've answered all my questions. How do you go from an idea of a manuscript to publishing? Like, how do you actually do that? Like, to actually go from where we are to where you are?
Well, I feel like I'm going to quote Anne Lamott word by word, you know, that idea. But I think that idea is really, if you're working on something, like, I know every time I sit down, I'm terrified that nothing's going to happen, but I just keep having to arrive at the desk and trust now in the process because it's worked twice before and that maybe it might work again. And so to keep that discipline, to keep arriving at the desk. I think in terms of publishing and I like entering and stepping into the fray, coming to festivals, doing workshops, entering competitions, sending work to journals, I think that was, like, I felt by the time Peter Strauss rang me that I had kind of really tried my best to be part of a culture. Even though I'd go to festivals and I wouldn't know anyone or workshops, you know, I was trying to step into it. And so I think that would be my advice. And it's lonely, you know, sitting in front of the black screen, but things happen when you do. And like Hemingway always talked about, you know, if you keep doing it, the unconscious will come like to you because you're sitting in the desk and it's ready and you've trained yourself into that method of working.
Hemingway also said, kill your darlings. That's what you were saying about cutting.
Just listening to you talking about get out of the car and find your own way home or thinking about hitchhiking, is this you're exploring risk-taking, something that you might not want to do yourself in real life, but you're wondering what might happen in your imagination about risk and how you approach risk?
Can you, forgive me, I think maybe the plane, could you just say that one more time? Forgive me, I heard about risk-taking.
Sorry, and it's a very base Australian accent. When you're talking about get out of the car and find your own way home, or you're talking about hitchhiking, is it exploring in your own mind risk-taking, something that you might not be able to do in real life, but thinking about where risk might take you?
Yeah, so I'm not a risk taker. I'm like really averse to, like, I've never been on one of those, like, you know, where you go to those theme parks and people go on those insane. I'm not a thrill seeker at all, but I also grew up in the 1970s, and like that's I always have like all my where I lived, and it's kind of, it is in the first book, but not totally located. There was a house up the road from us where the father in that house had been involved in a company in California that had cut down redwoods that were subsequently dumped. And when Charles Manson was in prison and made his death list, that man was on his death list. And so when in the early 1970s, they actually had those lights that switched on when you passed, like sensor lights. If I saw a Volkswagen bus, like I ran, I was like, it's the Manson family, you know, coming to get me. And at the same time, like the exact time of this, where my first novel is set, 1981, like the Atlanta child murders were happening, where young black children were just disappearing and being found days later. And it went on and on. And in my childhood imagination, I was a worrier. I still am. You know, I find it hard to let go of my children. I'm trying. You know, I'm a worrier. But I think that sense of threat was always there. And because my sister was, you know, assaulted in a car as a child, and she jumped out of a moving car. That's slightly a spoiler, but it happens, like, literally at the start of the book. So, I think that the books, in a way, are often... Like, someone asked me, was your sister upset that you wrote about that? And I was like, well, I did ask her. But I also think she felt really seen. Like, we were in a big family. We didn't tell my mother. Like, my mother didn't know about that for, like, a year. And my sister was, you know, hurt. But back then, we didn't tell our mother. And I think the fact that I'd worried about it, like, for 40-some years made my sister feel seen. And maybe sometimes in fiction, we're trying to like fix things that are hurt. Mm. I think that's...
Yeah. And do we have time for one more? Last question, I think just one.
Hi, thank you for being here. Besides handing her a book, your book, what should one say to a person who you feel is being manipulated, like how you seem to be describing a manipulator?
Oh, wow.
The woman in the... Is this the woman who disappears, the woman in the bad relationship?
Well, more the daughter, by the sounds of it, from where I'm coming from. I haven't read your book yet, but I will go and get it.
So, the younger daughter, when she goes to, you know, she's very young and she's 4 years old, and the family are denied access, and she's quite, she's in a very cloistered environment. And interestingly, like, the aunt does try to reach her in different ways, or to do vigilance, I guess, by getting in contact with the state, because he hasn't, you know, sent his curriculum to the state, and she's found that out. But in terms of Dina, who's in the bad relationship, I've thought about this a lot, about times that we fail people, because we don't know what to do. And she comes from a really close family who start to take the path of least resistance because they're trying not to upset her, and they're also trying to continue to see the niece and granddaughter. You know, that so they begin to kind of also collude in the fiction of what's happening in the house. And I think, you know, socially, it's important for us to, I think, talk about it more, learn more, listen more. In the book, the sister who's left never gets over it, never gets over the fact that she didn't do more. And even though she recognizes, like, the times that she tried to get her out, and she does get her out. It's something else, you know, that happens. But I'm not, I probably haven't, because I'm not, I don't feel qualified to say this is what we should be doing, even though I've read quite a bit about it. And you know, I have been in a similar situation, not experiencing it, but having someone experiencing it and feeling paralyzed. Yeah, and it's not a good feeling to not be able to help someone that you know needs help. I hope I've answered that. And also, you said welcome to Adelaide, and I just wanted to say I have never been to such a beautiful... I swam in the sea this morning, and just thank you for all of Adelaide for, like, this event. It's just so beautiful here.
Thank you, Yuna. You're so generous, and your books are... I think now you should, every single one of you, buy a copy and know what poetry and prose, when it's... I don't know, gold leaf together, is just something wonderful. But you need to take your time. Thank you.
Helen, thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you.